You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this episode is presented by Emma Louise Fenelon.
Long-time listeners of this podcast may remember that several years ago, I interviewed Rachel Francis and Joanna Fleck about their book on vicarious trauma, burnout, and collective care in the legal profession. I've been increasingly interested in the subject ever since. For some people in the legal profession, experience of vicarious trauma will hit them all at once, and for others, myself included, it's a slow realization that the subject matter we are working with day in, day out, is having an impact. I am delighted to have here with me Dr. Anna Colton, a clinical psychologist with years of experience working in particular with barristers and clients with PTSD and complex trauma, and also Rachel Marcus of One Crown Office Row, who, like me, shares an interest in talking candidly about this subject. Thank you both so much for being here. Turning to you first, Dr. Colton, and first I will check, do you mind if I call you Anna?
Please call me Anna.
So first then, how common in your experience is vicarious trauma in the legal profession?
So in my experience, there is a significant amount of vicarious trauma in the legal profession and at the bar in particular, especially within the fields of family law, human rights law, immigration and criminal law. And before we think about the factors at play, it would be great to take a moment to very briefly outline what happens in the brain when we talk about trauma. So our amygdala, which is a tiny almond-shaped bit in our brain, is the danger center of our brain. All information goes into the amygdala. And in the course of normal events, we go to sleep, the information gets processed, it gets date stamped, time stamped, filed, stored, and a kind of template goes into the filing cabinet. So when something similar happens again, the brain goes, oh, yes, yes, opens that filing cabinet. There's the template. The memories are stored elsewhere. And it feels all reasonably well known and in the run of everyday life. When trauma happens, and that can be anything that's just deeply shocking, that process, that filing, the date stamping, the time stamping, the storage, it doesn't happen. So the information remains in the amygdala, which means that it doesn't get processed and located in the past. So it still feels like it's happening in the present. And that's why when any information comes in that is resonant with whatever the traumatic event was, we feel like it happens to us again. So that is a kind of a whistle stop explanation of what happens in the brain with trauma.
I imagine, though, that it's something that is resonating already with anyone who does any of the areas that you have mentioned. But I would probably also add to that inquest law, clinical negligence, personal injury, sexual abuse, all of those areas of law that covers that sort of traumatic subject matter. But then going back to how you have come across this in the legal profession, can you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Sure. So I've been married to a barrister for, you know, the last 25 years. So I feel pretty familiar with the legal profession. And indeed, you can hear traumatic content or have something traumatic happen to you in any walk of life and actually in any area of the law. But I work a lot with lawyers who hit burnout and have to either come out of work or take a step back for a bit. And almost always there's some trauma in there because it becomes overwhelming. And all of the symptoms that we experience in acute anxiety, stress, and also the flashbacks, the distress, the inability to kind of stop ruminating, have to work through those. So I train sets of chambers, I train clerks in particular and staff to recognize mental health difficulties. And then in my clinic work, I work a lot with trauma and burnout, particularly at the bar, but in the legal profession in general as well. And there are a number of factors that contribute to vicarious trauma. As you've mentioned, all of those areas where the content that lawyers have to be exposed to is distressing, shocking, traumatic in and of itself. And that can be content through disturbing images. It can be through listening to audio. It can literally be through taking witness accounts because our brain will react to the information in a similar way as if it's happening to us. It'll be different, but it'll be similar. And so if we become deeply shocked, or a lawyer becomes deeply shocked by what they're seeing or hearing, that you don't have to have it happen to you. That is shocking in itself, and the brain will respond with the trauma response. And then, of course, there's the weight of responsibility that lawyers feel to obtain justice for their clients. And in some situations, obviously, you know, if they don't win or if they don't get the outcome they want, their clients may be at massive disadvantage and at risk of significant and increased trauma, going back to terrible situations from which maybe they'd fled. So the stakes are incredibly high when it comes to the work that people are doing. And each one of these topics could be a discussion in and of itself. So whistling through them a little bit. There are the other factors as well, such as you need to know what you're feeling. Because if you don't know what you're feeling, you feel overtaken by it and overwhelmed by it. You don't understand what's happening to you, and you don't have a frame of reference by which to kind of process it and have a conversation and put in support structures. And you then become increasingly overwhelmed. And then the coping strategies that one can use can be unhelpful in and of themselves. So there becomes a vicious cycle really quite quickly, along with the kind of the common belief that I hear all the time in my work, particularly in clinic, but also just when I'm with chambers and lawyers, is I can't be struggling because I've only heard these stories. It hasn't happened to me. This isn't my stuff. I have absolutely no right to feel so distressed. I've not gone through it. And of course, you don't have to go through it. And it's not a competition in pain. You know, this is not what this is about. And I think it's so important that everybody acknowledges when you're exposed to any kind of content like this, you have a right to feel. And indeed, if you didn't feel, there'd be something really wrong, because it's natural to feel. And finally, you know, there are certain thinking styles which are very common, particularly to barristers, that increase psychological vulnerability. These factors include, for example, black and white thinking. I've won or I've lost, I'm wrong or I'm right, it's true or it's false. There's not the nuance that can be so helpful to us in terms of integrating how we think and understanding what's going on. There's such a powerful belief in right and wrong, a powerful belief in fairness, and a really strong sense of social justice. Now, these are all wonderful things and important things, but of course they increase vulnerability when it comes to feeling distress and feeling that you're not coping brilliantly and the stakes are really high, and anxiety rises when you feel the stakes are so high. And then that makes the brain hypervigilant to threat, and that increases the likelihood of vicarious trauma and trauma type responses.
It occurs to me that there are a number of ways that trauma can arise in our work as lawyers. There's obviously first working with traumatized clients and knowing how to both support them and elicit the necessary information to enable us to properly represent their interests, and to do that in a way that doesn't make things worse. And then second, there's managing our own response to the people we represent and the subject matter that we come across every day. And then there's also the responsibility that comes with managing or supervising pupils or juniors as lead counsel, and then sort of in a more general sense, looking out for colleagues and those that you work with when working in teams. Because although we're self-employed, sometimes we do work in teams. Rachel, I know that you've dealt with each of these aspects in your own career, but can I ask, how has this arisen for you?
So taking each of those things in turn, and firstly, working with traumatized clients, I sometimes think there can be a bit of an uneasy tension between not wanting to further traumatize your client by delving into what happened to them, and what I've sometimes called the vampiric nature of the law, which is that the worse the evidence that you elicit, potentially the better the case and the better the outcome. And the first time I became really acutely aware of that was, I think, in my first year of practice, where I was sent to Sudan to take witness statements from returned Darfuri asylum seekers to find out what had happened for them. Now, I slowly realized I was eliciting those horrendous stories without there being any direct benefit for them in telling their story. It was a completely non-therapeutic framework, and without there being any mental health care or safety net at all for them to access after speaking to me and bringing up everything that had happened to them. But it's not just the process of evidence gathering that can be traumatizing or re-traumatizing. I was actually in a mediation last week with a very traumatized client who found the whole process impossibly difficult. And I don't think I've ever seen a client so distressed and dysregulated and then shut down. And I felt I really got it wrong in terms of preparing her and getting her through it. And it was also terrible for the process itself. So she had to leave before the end as she just couldn't cope. And I am sure there are ways in which I could have set up the process which might have made that easier for her to bear and get through it. So I'd really like to hear from Anna what she thinks about that. The second thing that you mentioned, Emma, was our own response to the stuff that we deal with. And I tend to think generally that you end up in the field of work that you can cope with. I think I would find, for example, family work emotionally very difficult. But generally, I have absolutely no problem with the injury and death that I deal with in clinical negligence and inquests. There are very rare occasions when something's got under my skin. So, for example, doing a case about the death of a 7-week-old when I was pregnant, I got very tearful and fearful when my own baby reached 7 weeks, and I luckily realised very quickly what was going on. Or once I was in the middle of an inquest about a young mother with psychosis, and in the middle went to the opera, Il Trovatore, for opera buffs who might see the relevance, and found myself weeping completely uncontrollably through the first act, which I guess was sort of cathartic in the really true sense of the word. Another time I had a bereavement when I was in the middle of an inquest and found it really very difficult to manage my own emotional responses, not during the inquest, but at the beginning and end of every day. And the third thing, and I think this is what led me initially, Emma and Anna, to approach both of you to suggest that we do a podcast about this, because it was in relation to some of my pupils. And I've asked the relevant people their permission to talk about this. So firstly, I asked a recent pupil how she was finding the switch from her last seat in public law to medical law with me. And what I really meant was dealing with thousands of pages of medical records and how she was coping with that logistically, and in terms of how she approached evidence. But what she said was, well, is it always so sad? And I thought, well, yes. The answer is yes. And then secondly, and this is where I feel like I didn't really have the proper tools or I'd lost them somewhere along the way, was when another recent pupil started with me. The first task I gave him was to complete a chronology of evidence I'd started in relation to an inquest. And I handed over my initial draft and launched into my explanation of the task. And after he'd asked some very insightful questions about the task and the case, he then said, can I just ask one more thing? I can see that the first three entries on this chronology are first suicide attempt, second suicide attempt, third suicide attempt. And he said, how do you cope with the subject matter of the stuff you do? And I thought, I have totally got this wrong. I am so hardened to it. And I completely failed to see that it might be very shocking for somebody who was coming across it for the first time. And what I wondered was, should I have given some sort of trigger warning? I don't even know what that means. And how should I go about that? And how else could I have approached preparing my pupils for what they are going to see with me? So those are my answers, really, and the sorts of things I've come across in those three areas, Emma, that you raised.
Anna, any thoughts on any number of things that Rachel's just mentioned? I imagine you do.
So many thoughts. First of all, everything you describe is completely normal. We become emotionally activated by content we hear that resonates with us, be it happy, be it sad, be it anxiety provoking. It's completely normal. And it's great that you spotted when your son was 7 weeks old that that's what was playing out. That's why you were so anxious. I mean, you know, that I imagine would have helped you work through it. Often we don't spot, we have no idea, we're just overtaken by it. So it's really important. I was thinking, Rachel, listening to you talk about your client who became so distressed that she had to leave. And when you said, you know, I'm sure I just could have done it better. I must have done it wrong, done it so badly, but actually maybe not. Because what happens in trauma is that if it's not processed, then describing what you've been through can be like reliving. And so you're back there again. And it's why the most effective treatment for PTSD and trauma is what's called, you may or may not have heard of it, EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which doesn't require talking, because sometimes the talking is like reliving and the distress is the same as when we went through it. So I wondered whether that was going on with your client, that it just hadn't been processed at all and it was so raw because it felt like it was happening all over again. Maybe, maybe not, but that is really common.
And I wonder, actually, if, and of course, EMDR is something that we deal with, our psychiatrist experts recommend it all the time in clinical negligence. But with that client, for example, she was invited at the beginning of the mediation by the mediator to say her piece. And I do wonder whether actually that just wasn't helpful at all, because it's not a contained situation. She has the defendant sitting across the table from her, and they are going to listen to her story and then go on to tell her why she's not going to succeed and why her case is not worth anything. And so I wonder if that actually is not a helpful thing, and that mediators shouldn't be inviting that with a claimant whose profile is one of psychiatric injury and trauma.
I mean, it is certainly something that ought to be really thoughtfully considered and possibly done on a case-by-case basis, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I certainly wanted to ask you about, Anna, is this term, which is increasingly used, trauma-informed work. I was hoping you might be able to tell us what that means and how it might help those of us working with clients who have been through unimaginably awful things to support them as best we can.
It's a great question, because you're absolutely right. Trauma-informed is everywhere, isn't it? My understanding is that trauma-informed means that a person has an understanding of what trauma is, what happens in the brain, what happens in the body in response to trauma, because it is a very physiological and neurological process. You know, it's not, I hate the term psychosomatic, but what happens to us, what we feel emotionally and physically, is not psychosomatic. It is very real. And we need to know that. We need to acknowledge that. So that is what I think trauma-informed is. The other thing is that there is an understanding that maybe trauma is not what happens to you necessarily, but trauma is about what you believe about yourself in response to the event that you've been through. That sounds a bit woolly. So to make it a bit clearer, if you take, for example, something like the Manchester Arena bombing, not every single person in that arena will have developed PTSD or a more complex trauma presentation. They won't. They may all have had, you know, some symptoms, but actually some will have had an interpretation of, my God, I was so lucky. I was in this terrible event and I'm fine and my family's fine. And other people will have had a response of, oh my goodness, I'm so unsafe. The world is so unsafe. I can't go out. I can't trust anyone. How am I ever meant to know? I just need to stay at home. And it's that latter type of response that is more likely to lead to a development of PTSD or a complex trauma process. So not everybody will respond in the same way. And I think that is really important to understand as well, because of course, every single one of your clients is different.
And if anything that we're talking about is resonating with someone listening now, and they think, gosh, that's either relevant to my practice or relevant to my life in some way, what do you suggest they do? What resources would you recommend to enable them to read up on this and become a little bit more informed? I obviously know that, or I hope that listeners are familiar with our previous episode on vicarious trauma and the authors Joanna Fleck and Rachel Francis, who we interviewed about their book on vicarious trauma in the legal profession. So I would recommend that book, but I imagine you have others in mind that might help lawyers in our situation do this work in a better way.
Absolutely. It's such a big topic nowadays that there are loads of resources and a lot of really wonderful trauma specialists who are creating content online, who are writing. But I think one of the kind of best books still is Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score. Bessel van der Kolk is one of the preeminent psychiatrists in the field, and it's just a really brilliant, accessible, and extremely expert description of all things trauma treatment. So that's really superb. Gabor Maté, who you may have heard of, writes a lot and speaks a lot about it as well. Even the Law Society and the Bar Council have information on vicarious trauma on their websites. I was having a quick look, and there is some information with some links. Now, EMDR UK and EMDR International both have really fantastic websites with loads of helpful information on how to understand what's going on and how the treatment might work. EMDR is NICE guideline recommended first line treatment of choice for trauma, for PTSD, for complex trauma, for anything trauma. And certainly it's unbelievably effective. It's got many randomized control trials in support of it. And I mean, I use it all the time and it is really powerful and helpful. So those are recognized and accredited sites for EMDR. So if you are struggling, anyone listening is struggling themselves, then EMDR is a very good, finding a clinician who works using EMDR, I would recommend doing that as well.
Rachel, do you have any tips?
What I thought I might talk a little bit about is managing our own responses to this, because I think we start out thinking we are made of Teflon and nothing affects us. And I was certainly one of those. But especially becoming more aware of the effect that all of this has attritionally over a career dealing only with injury and trauma, and also wanting to support those more junior and those starting out, I thought it would be helpful to sort of go back really to basics on this, because there are three linked things and then one really more fundamental one. Three linked things which are in relation to how we manage our practice. The first one for me has been coming into chambers and making chambers my primary place of work rather than home. And that for me has been absolutely fundamental. And it was about 2 years after lockdown when we were all at home when I thought, I can't do this anymore. I actually cannot manage this sort of work anymore. And all it took was coming back into chambers and being able to communicate, talk about cases with others who do the same sort of thing. Really fundamental for me. The second thing, and I think it's linked, is properly demarcated time to devote to work. For me, the answer to stress and the feeling of lack of control and burnout is, and I know you might disapprove of this, work. And it always has been. And I suspect many barristers are of the same sort of psychological makeup. The answer to stress for me is work. And I know that now. It's just cracking on and doing it. Thirdly, and conversely, properly demarcated time for family, exercise, and the sort of nourishing things like, for me, it would be the arts like theatre and music. I know that is easier said than done. And the last two, exercise and sort of, you know, more nourishing creative pursuits, often fall by the wayside completely when things get tough. But I don't work Friday night or Saturdays, and I never have in nearly 20 years at the bar. That's inflected by my own family heritage and the traditions that we have. But I do think that it is possible that everyone can mark out some sacrosanct space in every week. And finally, and this is not a practice point, but it's just a really more fundamental one. And I think it links, Anna, to what you said at the beginning about how we process memory, and that is sleep. And this is, again, very much do as I say, not as I do, because I'm guilty of very much not sleeping enough ever. But it is noticeable how much more manageable the subject matter is, not just, of course, the work, because that's obvious, but the subject matter when we've had enough sleep. So those are my three practice points and fourth fundamental life point. And I think I will make a point of it with pupils from now on, is making sure that they realise that they need to work out for them what works. And also that demarcation, I think, is really fundamental.
That's so interesting. And so, Anna, in terms of practical advice then for working with traumatised clients, what pointers would you give?
You know, it's such a helpful conversation. You commented, Rachel, I might disapprove of working when stressed. I think that is a bit more nuanced. I think if the stress is about I've got work to do and I want to avoid it, then the only way to get through that stress is to work, is to get the work done. And I would completely agree with that. But if work is a coping strategy and the way that you deal with tricky emotions is to work relentlessly, that can cause problems. So I think it depends on what kind of scenario you're talking about. But if you've got work that needs to be done, avoidance is going to make the stress worse. And the only way to get through it is to do the work. I was also thinking that we have a concept in the CBT, cognitive behavior therapy literature, called the stress bucket. And this concept is, if you picture a bucket, throughout the course of every single day, the bucket fills with distress, with kind of bits of trauma or everyday events or anxiety or stress, financial stress, parenting stress, home stress, work stress, whatever. And over the course of the day, that bucket fills up. And over the course of the week, that bucket fills up. Now, if you don't have any outlets to empty the stress from the bottom of that stress bucket, it's going to hit the top and overflow really very quickly. And that's when kind of burnout, breakdown happens and life gets unmanageable. That's when stress becomes overwhelming. And so the things Rachel was talking about, you know, having nourishing time with family, exercise, sleep, the arts, it doesn't actually matter. Doing things that you enjoy, that is how you empty the stress out of the bottom of the stress bucket, which enables you to continue living your life, which has inherent stress in it. We can't get through life without stress. So for anybody who is kind of visually minded, it's a really nice image. You can stick it into Google and Google stress bucket and loads of different drawings will come up. But it's really important. And actually, when working with people who've burnt out or who've had some kind of breakdown, one of the first things we have to do is put in those support structures, which enable people to release the stress in the bottom of the bucket, because otherwise, actually, their mental health will be increasingly vulnerable. These things are protective of mental health. And if your mental health is protected, your work is protected and your family is protected and your life is protected.
So that helps you then be a more effective lawyer and a more effective advocate for your clients. But coming to working with those clients, and as Rachel and I know, often traumatized clients, people with diagnosed psychiatric conditions as a result of trauma, what pointers would you give to lawyers, to people like Rachel and myself, working with that sort of cohort?
Well, if you have a diagnosed psychiatric condition and you're able to take some proper psychiatric medical advice on how to ask questions about something that is going to be profoundly difficult, then please do. Please try and understand, if possible, the condition your client has, because that will inform how you interact with them. There's the inherent conflict that we named earlier between needing information and not wanting to traumatize your client. So if it's possible to ring fence the information you need, that's very helpful. So saying to a client, I need to ask about this. I know it might be very distressing. We've got an hour. How much can you go into it? What is okay for you to discuss in this hour? Because we can't run over it. So you're putting a boundary, you're putting a context, you're putting a kind of a, almost like a vessel, a container around the time, and you're helping them to think about and have some agency in what they disclose in that hour. You can maybe hopefully always have a little bit more time if there is that available. But a very dysregulated, very distressed client isn't actually going to tell you anything. Whereas a client who feels contained will be able to disclose more in a much more helpful way. So being clear about the time available and giving them some agency about what they disclose to you, and giving them maybe sometimes even a kind of a, you can hold your hand up if it's getting too much. Please tell me to stop if you're feeling overwhelmed. Some people prefer a code word, some people prefer a signal, other people just are able to say stop. Please just stop. So that's a really helpful conversation to have at the beginning, because it acknowledges that this is going to be difficult. I would say, if at all possible, only ask what you need to know. You're not a therapist. You're not in a therapeutic relationship. Please don't try and stray into that territory. Sometimes clients will want to tell you their story, and there may be a place for that. But actually, it is much kinder at the outset to say, I know you've had a terrible time and you have a story to tell. This isn't the moment or the space, and I don't want you to feel upset by that. So I'm being really clear about the parameters of our conversation. So you acknowledge that there is a story, but you say that you're not equipped to deal with it, or you don't need it now, or you can't have it now. And that is protective. Then it means that if they start to tell their story in a way that is difficult for you or unhelpful, you're able to say, I just need to remind you actually that this isn't the moment for that. And it doesn't feel unkind, because you've set out the context before you started.
Can I ask, you say that is protective. Is that protective of the lawyer or also of the client?
It's protective, I think, of lawyer and client. You know, both of you potentially will feel distress at the stories that you're hearing. It's very protective to give people boundaries. But you are going to have client after client after client after client for hopefully very many years. You are going to hear a lot. You don't need to know every detail of everybody's trauma unless it's 100% relevant to the case. So do think in advance, what do I need to know? And what can I leave? Obviously within the scope of your case and making the best case for your client. And decision-making is really important in trauma, because when trauma happens, it happens to us. We are frequently powerless, and many of your clients will have been powerless and out of control and with no agency whatsoever. And so any decision that you can give them in the process of retelling their story or telling you what you need to know is going to help them. It can be as straightforward as, what would you like me to call you? Right? Because if something traumatic's happened, no one's going to have said to them, what would you like me to call you? That's irrelevant. And that's just not the nature of it. So, you know, what would you like me to call you? Would you like to cover this first or that first? We're going to need to cover these areas. You choose the order. You know, you can do those things. It's really helpful. So you give your clients agency. That is something that they will absolutely have lost in whatever the trauma is. And you can't underestimate the importance of that.
That's really interesting, Anna, because in a clinical negligence context in particular, the claim will almost invariably arise from circumstances where clients have felt disempowered because their concerns have been dismissed or downplayed, or they've put themselves in the hands of professionals who have more knowledge about how a system works, and in particular their own body system, than they do. And that's got wrong for them. And now we're asking them to put their trust in us as legal professionals. And one of the things I wondered about was how we can reduce that power gradient in a way so they feel empowered in their own case without either being allowed to think that it's all down to them or giving them unrealistic expectations.
In as much as you possibly can, allow them to join you in the decision-making process. Make it as collaborative as possible. You may hear this and go, don't be daft, this is just not how we can do it. And that's really fine. You are the expert in the law. You know, they're seeking your help because of your expertise, and they need that. But in as much as you can collaborate and see yourself as walking alongside them rather than deciding what they must do, that's a really helpful stance. You know, you can have a conversation, you know, I think we should do this. How do you feel about it? You know, is there anything else you'd like me to add? These are not difficult questions, but they will communicate to your client that you are holding them in mind, that you're thinking about them, and that you're wanting to involve them. And none of, well, I don't know about the holding in mind, but they will probably feel none of those things have happened to them in whatever they've been through.
And so then turning to managing our own response to working with traumatized clients or traumatic subject matter, a recent article in Counsel magazine by Mark Mason highlighted the need for supervision for barristers of the kind that is typically found within the training and work of psychologists, social workers, and others. And I have to say, this is the first time that I came across this suggestion that barristers or lawyers might benefit from supervision. But first, Anna, for the unfamiliar, what is supervision and how might it help, or how does it help those who use it?
So supervision is a space that is prearranged, pre-designated. It is a time and a space for debriefing, reflecting, self-reflection, understanding your own responses to the content you're hearing, thinking with someone about the impact on you, and thinking with somebody about the impact you have on your client. Sometimes there are difficult dynamics at play, and being able to understand those, being able to understand if your buttons have been pressed, and having a space where you can do that. Now, it is a part of my training as a clinical psychologist. No clinical psychologist operates without supervision. We have it weekly through training, weekly through, you know, the first few years of practice, and it never stops. You might just have greater gaps between supervision sessions as you become more experienced. But my view is that for me, the day that I say I don't need supervision anymore is the day I ought to stop practicing, because it's about self-reflection, reflection on your practice, understanding how you work, understanding the impact of the work on you and the impact of your interventions on others. And it needs to be facilitated by somebody who is skilled. You know, there is peer supervision, you know, and often actually going to the pub and having a drink and discussing your cases serves a supervisory role, but it's better done as well in a more formal structure.
Speaking of the pub, Rachel, it does strike me that it's one of the things that, for better or worse, has died a bit of a death post-COVID. And I wonder about filling that space that used to exist, however it manifested, where colleagues got together and told war stories.
Yes. So previously that space might have existed in the pub after work, but actually there was a quasi-formal structure that used to exist in chambers, and in many chambers, you know, might well still do, of chambers tea. which would happen at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock when people were back from court. And it happened every single day without fail. And that was where everyone got together, regardless of seniority, to decompress and, as you say, share war stories. That doesn't happen in as formal a way anymore in many chambers, partly because I think tighter deadlines to turn around, and partly because, I mean, certainly in our chambers, we felt unfair for pupils to be making tea for older members of chambers, and actually there were better ways of doing things. But I think what we've lost in that is that space where there is somewhere every day for people to go if they feel the need to offload. And now that so many people work from home, that even the water cooler chats or chats by the kettle or by the photocopier aren't there anymore. And I think that there is less of that space for people to talk, and certainly less space for that regular forum to happen. And I think the profession really needs to think about the ways it can encourage and foster that sort of informal supervision, as it were, and might need to think about how we put in place slightly more formal space and time for it. You know, perhaps you could have members at a range of seniority who are designated as listeners for anyone needing to decompress, maybe with office hours. Maybe we just need to reintroduce chambers tea.
I mean, if I can jump in, I think that is so important, really important. I just kind of, in thinking about how that would differ from a more formal supervision, I think the thing about a formal supervision is that someone can turn around to you and say, are you sure that's not your own stuff getting in the way? You know, that self-reflection, that kind of, hang on a minute, what's playing out for you? Because what you've just described may not actually be about your client. Are you sure you want that coming into your work?
That's very interesting, Anna, because one of the things that you mentioned is being aware of your own triggers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite tricky at the bar, because while you can more or less, as I mentioned, I think right at the top of this discussion, especially as you get more senior, you develop your expertise in areas which don't trigger you to an uncomfortable degree. But within those areas, there is a difficulty with the cab rank rule. You can't turn away a client because you think their particular case or their particular manner might trigger something in you.
I think that's an interesting one, because it is the idea, and certainly for me, the sort of slow burn that some of this impact can have, the way that it doesn't just suddenly appear because you come across a car crash. It creeps up on you. And I think that's the sort of thing that we need to make sure that those junior to us are aware of, those coming up in the profession, those we're supervising, managing, working with in teams. And so, Anna, I was just wondering, in terms of the advice that you would give to lawyers who are supervising others, typically more junior, often younger, and I think that's also important because there's less life experience there as well, on cases with the potential for vicarious trauma. Do you have any tips in terms of how we should consider that role?
So I think there needs to be kind of a teacher-mentor component as well. And if you assume a teacher-mentor component, then you can be a little more holistic in your approach to more junior members of chambers or more junior lawyers. And I think that one of the things that's very important, and I imagine oft not done, is giving explicit permission from day one to kind of bring issues that maybe crop up in the course of the work that are troubling for you, and not just from a legal perspective. Because that acknowledges that that's a thing, and that that's probably a thing for everybody, and that it's okay to talk about it, and it destigmatizes it. And so saying, you know what, you might find some of the content of this case, or you might find the nature of this work distressing. It is. We all find that. Please come and talk to me. Please raise it, and we'll think it through together. That explicit permission may be enough on its own for many people. It's so powerful when that's given. It creates a culture of shared thinking. It creates a culture of discussion, and it changes the kind of ethos within a firm or a set of chambers to one that is compassionate and supportive, one that acknowledges the impact of this work, the attritional nature of it, and the real kind of potential psychological harm. So that would be my very top tip. And also, if someone says that to you, if someone gives that explicit permission, then they are modelling being able to talk about it. And so they're leading by example as well.
I think one of the helpful things I certainly found was when more senior members of the profession, certainly in particular women I looked up to, were very open about the fact that they went to therapy and acknowledge that that helped them in their work, because there is, I think, even still stigma around admitting any sort of vulnerability, that you're not Teflon in sort of all aspects of your life, because that's very much what, when we turn up at court with our game face, we are trying to project. And yeah, there are a couple of women who have been open about that, and it sort of made me think, well, maybe that's something that, you know, would help my own practice. So, you know, for others listening, it's also something I've benefited from enormously for years because of the kind of work that I do. So I would encourage people, if they are struggling, to seek out a specialist, as you've suggested, Anna. So just sort of final thought then, and Rachel, I might just ask you about this. One of the things that for newbies, for people setting out on this career path, whether going down the solicitor route, going down the bar route, might be thinking is, am I cut out for this at all? Because often we find people applying to our chambers, most, if not all of them, have a real sense of social justice that's apparent in their applications, and often, admirably, a real sense of idealism. They want to do this work because they think it's important, and they think in a small way they might make things better for other people without being too Pollyanna about it. What would you say to them?
It's interesting because, of course, you have a sense of social justice or idealism, as you say. They're attracted to work, a lot of our applicants, to human rights inquests, public inquiries, personal injury, all of those necessarily require contact with traumatic subject matter. One of the things you say about idealism in all of those areas of law raises for me the issue of moral injury and the sort of burnout that can happen when you're forced to act in a way that's contrary to your own moral compass, when you feel you're complicit in a system that's causing harm. Now, that arises in the context of healthcare professionals in resource-depleted settings, which sadly includes the NHS, when you have to turn people away. And we've seen this in representing healthcare professionals, for example, in relation to the COVID pandemic. But I think it can be a real issue in some areas of law. So partly, it is understanding the areas of law that you are good at coping with and those which trigger, whether it's an emotional response to the subject matter or whether actually you cannot manage the feelings of moral injury that arise. But Anna, given that I think it's almost inevitable in some areas, I do wonder whether you have any advice for practitioners in those areas of law.
It does come back to self-awareness, self-reflection. What is my stuff? Because there is a, you know, it's a self-selecting group. You choose an area of law, you select. And when you have a very strong moral compass, or possibly when you've been through things in your own life, you know, a lot of people will say, I want to make sure that that never happens to anyone else. Or I want to go and, you know, advocate for people who are in a similar situation as I was. Now, that's great. Genuinely, you know, that is a wonderful thing. We need that. Some people will manage it more than others. Some people will be able to tolerate the feelings and have resources available to them psychologically and in terms of support structures within and outside work to make it doable. Other people won't. There's no right or wrong, but people need to be self-aware enough to say, you know what, I really wanted to do this, but actually it's too close to home. Either I need to get some therapy, or I need to get some formal supervision, or I need to step away and do something different, or a bit of all of it. So I think there's a real piece on self-reflection and self-awareness there. You mentioned much earlier, Rachel, you know, that kind of, have I become hardened to it? In some ways, we have to harden a little bit. Otherwise, it's overwhelming. I've worked with severe anorexia with people on inpatient units and in day patients and outpatients I'm very lucky I haven't lost anyone. But, you know, it can be life and death, and it can be really anxiety provoking. You have to find an outlet, and you have to harden enough to be able to do the work. You can't be too distressed, because otherwise you can't advocate. You can't do the job. But it's a process of trying to navigate that and think again, you know, okay, I can have some black humor about this. It really helps me. You know, my colleagues and I, there's a lot.
I would agree with that. Essential.
I do think that black humour is absolutely fundamental.
Yeah.
It's the sort of thing you see in healthcare professionals. You see it in about, it's absolutely fundamental in decompressing this stuff.
And I really want to say it's not a sign of disrespect. It is a sign of, I have to somehow move this out of my system so that I can get up tomorrow and go again. And of course, coming from the NHS, it's very difficult to be within a broken system, but you have to then also within that say, what am I able actually to do? And operate within the scope available to you. And sometimes that's extremely painful because, you know, in my position, for example, I can't find the right care for someone. So we have to make do. But that's still better than nothing. And so being quite realistic about what is within the scope of your work, what is within your gift to offer, and what is likely is so important to realism, and accept what you can't control and really commit to doing everything you can in the areas you might have some impact.
But I want to thank you both for contributing to what has been such a fascinating discussion. We will include a link to the resources mentioned in today's episode because I do think it's so important for all of us working in the legal profession to be a little bit more aware that the work that we do has an impact on ourselves and our colleagues and, I mean, on our families ultimately. But thank you both so much for joining this episode.
Thank you.
Thank you, Emma.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row.